Welcome to the Healing Theology Podcast, where we explore the intricate connections between religion and public health. I'm your host, Alejandra Salemi, founder of Healing Theology. Each week, we bring you conversations with thought leaders, experts, clergy, researchers, and scientists who are working to bridge the gap between faith and science. Together, we challenge misconceptions, spark meaningful dialogues, and discover how these two worlds can come together to create healthier, more united societies. Thank you for joining us on this journey of Season 2. Let's dive in. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Healing Theology Podcast. I'm excited for today's guest as we talk about housing insecurity, kind of housing justice as well, and just learning about this topic, but from the other side of the public health conversation or the public health and religion conversation, which is from a clergy member. Reverend Mary Downey is with us today. I would love to introduce you to her first before we jump into some conversation. So Reverend Mary Lee Downey is the CEO of the Hope Partnership, previously known as the Community Hope Center, which is a nonprofit founded by Downey in 2013. The partnership provides services to bring hope for those experiencing homelessness and poverty in Central Florida by focusing on trauma-informed care and empowering those they serve to determine their own success and sustainability. In the last 10 years, Hope Partnership and its entities have served over 100,000 individuals. The partnership focuses on housing first models of care and poverty alleviation. In 2016, Hope Partnership was awarded a prestigious Bank of America Neighborhood Builders Award, and in 2015 was awarded the Bob Allen Award by Walt Disney World for innovative approaches for helping those experiencing homelessness in their community. Downey and her incredible team are especially proud of their coordinated efforts to provide housing for those displaced by Hurricane Maria and were recognized for their work by the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Downey was awarded the 2019 Central Floridian of the Year Award and is humbled by how her community honors her to simply do her job and supporting families in need. Downey's most recent project is converting a motel into affordable housing and a Hope Village, a multifamily intentional community designed to provide housing for those in need in partnership with private, public, and faith-based organizations. Downey is a deacon in the United Methodist Church for the Florida United Methodist Conference. And Downey's focus is on missional outreach through social justice in nonprofit organizations. She's also one of my dear just role models, I think, in the ordination process. So I am just so honored to have you here with us today.
I am so grateful to be here. And I'm always very humbled when somebody reads my bio like that. So thank you for having me. And I adore you, as you know, so I can't wait for us to talk today.
Thanks. Yeah, I also, as I was reading your bio, I was like, you're so cool.
No.
I would love to check in with you and just kind of bring some humanity into the conversation. So how are you? How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing well, actually. I just got back from a 3-month sabbatical, which I'm very, very grateful for, in which I got to spend a lot of time with my husband and my 3 children who are growing too fast for me right now. And so that was just a real gift in my life to get to have that dedicated time. We did a lot of travel, kind of did a bucket list travel, and just super grateful for getting to do that. And yeah, so I'm doing really well. And I'm also overwhelmed with being back at work. I think last week, one of the things I was really pondering, you know, everybody's like, oh, what did you learn in sabbatical? Like, what was your big takeaway? And I really was like, I don't know. I don't know what that is. And then I came back to work last week and I was like, oh my God, my takeaway is I am so busy. Like, I am so busy. Like, how did I work at this capacity? So yeah. Last week was a little bit of a shock coming back into that daily busyness, but getting used to it again.
Yeah. And you wear a heavy role for sure. Or a heavy crown, I guess is how the saying goes. Cause you're doing a lot. I have known you since I was a little girl. I think we were like in the same kind of church spaces. And I've kind of watched this journey of you building and leading the Hope Partnership since I was little, fundraising and kind of living out your faith in such a tangible and necessary way. And so I can't imagine how like heavy that must be as you're growing this organization. I mean, because you're truly transforming Central Florida, I would say. Like, I feel like there's a lot. I mean, you can look up Reverend Downey and you can see news articles of like the ways that like housing policy in the local community is changing. If you could give us a summary of how you even got where you are being a clergy, but also leading such an important nonprofit outside of quote unquote traditional clergy roles, like, can you give us a little bit of a story there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long story, so I'm going to try to figure out, you know, what's the most succinct way to tell it. But I think in general, you know, I moved to this community in 2006, so almost 20 years ago now. I am from rural South Arkansas originally, and I also grew up in a lot of poverty, and there were spaces in my own personal life due to domestic violence in my household that kept me from having a safe place to call home. And there were moments in my life where I needed a support system. I needed someone to see me. I needed someone to hear me. I needed someone to believe me. And in reality, that did not exist. There were no safe people in my life who I could tell what was happening in my home. And so I think that in general, that's really where my motivation sits. It sits first in making sure that people have the right support system around them. So I think in general, it's taken me a long time to get to the point to say that out loud. I have a phenomenal mother who went through so much. And so it was hard for us to finally reckon that I would tell that story out loud, because obviously, even though none of that was her fault, the shame that goes along with being in a toxic home is hard, and people don't talk about it. And so it is one of the reasons why I do talk about it, because I want people to know that you can go through really hard things and you can continue to thrive outside of them. And so that's kind of what started my, I think, internal motivation was my own story. External motivation was looking around my community and seeing that there was absolutely no services for people who were experiencing poverty and homelessness that was coordinated. There were little pockets of nonprofits who were doing really good work. And I always like to say, like, there were people here and they cared, but most of them were really setting in what I would call mercy ministry work, meeting some basic needs of people, feeding ministries. Maybe they were doing a couple of night stays. You know, we had a benevolence fund at the church that I was serving at the time, but I really just wasn't seeing anybody accessing federal funds for one thing. I wasn't seeing anybody looking into, you know, the different programs that were available from both the federal and the state level. Those weren't really being administered well in this community. And a very fun fact about my growing up is my mom actually worked in housing. And so I had just this really weird knowledge about Section 8 and HUD housing and all of these things, just because I would intern and go to work with her. And, you know, we call it intern, but like looking back, it was just, she was keeping me safe. Right. And so I learned so much from just doing that. And so I started asking questions of our community, like, where are these things? Why aren't they existing? Why are there only 200 vouchers for this community when it comes to Section 8? Like, what's happening here? And just kind of found out that there wasn't a nonprofit who had been able to step into that role. And that process of discerning that and walking through that, that was probably about a 6-year process from about 2006 to 2012. I spent some time working at some other nonprofits during that time. One was a transitional housing program, shelter type of atmosphere. Another was an organization that works for people who are in recovery. And so just in general, just learned a lot about nonprofit world and what it looks like to manage it. And in 2011 was approached by a local congregation right outside the gates of, you know, our tourism industry, who really wanted to step into the gap. And they had an idea of what they wanted, and I had an idea of what I wanted. And I think I managed to talk them into my idea. And that's how Hope Partnership was born. It was born out of the idea that, you know, if we just had a building on our 192 corridor, which is where a majority of our families experiencing poverty and homelessness live, in motels and hotels or in their car, or also in the rural woods around the area, that if we just had a building that people could get to, that we would be able to serve them and be able to then access all of the services that was missing in the community. And so I always say, like, what Hope Partnership did and what Community Hope Center, which was our original name, did was really step into picking up the gaps. Like, we weren't here to say anybody was doing it wrong. We were here to pick up the gaps and to bring in more services. And that's what we've done. We changed our name to Hope Partnership in 2020. because we just grew so rapidly as an organization and we do so many different things. You know, what we say is our job is to make sure everyone has a safe place to call home. And so you name it, and I can connect to whatever is happening to that person, how we get them to housing. And so that's really kind of the overarching story. There's a lot in between there about what it looks like to be working in a local church. What it looks like. I spent a lot of time working in the local church. I spent a lot of time doing two jobs, running this organization and working in the local church as well. And also just what that looks like from an ordination standpoint. It was not easy for me to get ordained in our denomination. I think everybody knows that story, so I'm not afraid to share it because people didn't understand. I think people really struggle understanding people who want to live out their call the way that I'm living mine out.
That is a story I relate to greatly as I'm trying to get ordained in my little public health religion world. As we go through conversation, I want to talk about like your faith journey and how, if you could tell us how you understand your faith and responsibility as a faith leader in work with affordable housing policy and action, and how maybe, again, I don't know if you identify that as public health action, but how do you marry those two identities that maybe other people might not see as evident?
Yeah. First of all, housing is healthcare, 100%. So it absolutely is a public health issue when people do not have safe and adequate and dignified housing. We know that people who are living in places that we would say are unfit for habitation, so in the woods or in their cars or even in those motels and hotels that I mentioned earlier, those are all places that are not sustainable for the human body. They are not healthy places for people to live. They, you know, if you're outside, you have the elements. If you're in a hotel room, though, you have bed bugs and just all kinds of different things that could occur. And so when we think about housing, it absolutely is the first step to healthcare. In fact, when we talk about housing first model, we start with housing first because people's health improves. So if you think about it in the opposite direction, for a very long time, the strategy that we would utilize is people kind of had to meet some metrics before you would move them into housing. And so maybe they needed to be clean if they had an addiction, or maybe they needed to have a job, or maybe they needed, you know, to be able to, you know, meet all these different points. And what we found out is like those were actually hindering people from being able to be successful. And so the answer is you start with housing and then people's health improve and then they can go to work. And then they can maybe get clean if that's an issue for them, or they can address their mental health, because experiencing homelessness is a mental health crisis for most people, just in general. And so when they have access to a home, those things improve.
Do you find that people push back on you trying to argue your kind of calling, your clergy role in this work? I mean, you kind of hinted at that in your ordination process, but I'm just wondering, like, do people see you and your title as Reverend Mary Downey and question like, oh, what are you doing outside of the church? Or how does this really fit into a calling?
I think when I was getting ordained, the church was really in a place of major transition, especially around what does it mean to be a deacon? Mm-hmm. And so I think that a lot of that has shifted. I have seen us, especially at our conference, really start to ordain some people who are doing work similar to mine. And so that's very exciting to me. To see that maybe I opened some eyes to the people to understand that this call that really is rooted in justice. Deacons are called to justice. We are called to word sacrament, now sacrament, and also to justice and compassion. And so for me, I just definitely, that justice portion of that work is my lifeline. I want to clarify that when people think about a deacon and they think about the word compassion, they automatically think about mercy ministries. So that's probably the first thing, is people are always so confused that this isn't a shelter and this isn't a feeding ministry. Now, there are people outside right now on my door. There's about 150 people outside getting a hot meal today. So that happens, but that's not our motivation. Our motivation is you come to get a meal and then we talk about how we get you a housing plan, because that's our motivation, because housing is the justice issue. I think inside the local church is actually harder for people to understand why I don't work in a local church than outside. Because I think in general, and I've been in this community so long, that people know that my faith is my motivator. They know that that is what's keeping me in this work. And that belief in my faith belief is that, you know, the world can be better, that there is a kingdom that is stronger and better and more beautiful and more leaning towards that arc of justice than what we have right now. And that's my work. And that's what I want people to see. I have far less confusion outside the church. Inside the church, people are like, no, what do you do again? Mm-hmm. But outside, people are pretty cool about it. I really don't struggle with it at all.
Oh my gosh, just hearing your story and the way you and Reverend Esther Rodriguez, who also works with you at the Hope Partnership, are two, I would dare say, badass deacons in our conference. And I think it was both of you who taught me the phrases of mercy versus justice ministries. And I think we talked a little bit about already deacons different than elders, being called to the community, being called to justice. And I honestly, like, to me, it's a very radical calling. It's a calling to say, like, hey, there's like, I mean, you know, within the church, there's, you know, there's things that need to be done for sure and ways that we need to serve our people within the church. But there's a lot of brokenness in the world, and we're called to like find those pockets of hurt and actually like kind of uproot the sources of it. I think for many reasons, that's why my work in public health fits so well, because public health is also looking for places of illness and trying to find ways to bring health to it and healing to it. And it's radical. It's like, no, we don't just, you know, provide a band-aid to it. Like, we actually go and change the policies, change the ways, the systems, the mechanisms that allow these things to continue to happen. And it's, I don't know, I think it's just so important. But I recognize that the ideas of mercy ministries versus justice ministries is probably not a very well understood concept. I'm taking a global health and Christian theology course right now. So it's people who like it, at Duke Divinity, who like are probably doing this type of work, like interested in doing missionary work abroad, and they had never heard of mercy versus justice ministries. So I know it's not a very commonly known thing. I think it's important for us to define it here. So can you give me like a quick rundown of what a mercy versus justice ministry looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. I will say, I want to clarify so that it's very clear that Reverend Rodriguez is actually an elder. But I think that's important for people to hear, that elders can also work in extension ministries, because I do believe that we're, in general, when we talk about the clergy orders, we're all called to the same thing. Whether we live that inside or outside. And so when we talk about mercy versus justice, mercy is meeting a basic need in front of a person right now. So mercy is the idea of, like, this is not the best example, but it's the one I usually give because it makes the most sense, I think, to people. So like, you hear people say, like, I would give you this shirt off my back, right? That's mercy. Mercy is like, I would sacrifice everything for you. I would pour out my time, my energy, my, you know, whatever it is for you. It's mercy is can be sacrificial in some ways. And there's nothing wrong with mercy. There are times when mercy is absolutely necessary and important. Justice is, I have a shirt and you also deserve to have your own shirt. That's justice. Justice is, yes, I can be sacrificial for you, but you can also be sacrificial for me. Justice is being in right relationship. Justice is finding equality together. Justice is removing barriers for people in ways that don't even make sense that those barriers exist in some spaces. And mercy is repetitive. Mercy is, again, someone comes in, they're hungry, we're going to feed them. That's great. They come next week, they're hungry, we're going to feed them. That's great. But what do we, why are they hungry? That's justice. Why? Why are they hungry? And what can we do so that they can determine how they feed themselves? That's what we want. That's what we want when we say justice versus mercy. Lots of mercy happens at Hope Partnership because it is a doorway to get people through to the next step. It's a way to build relationships. It's a way to build trust. It's a way to build what we need to do the hard work of justice, which is long. Mercy is short. Mercy is transactional. Justice is long-term. Justice takes time. Justice, again, is shifting and changing your community and also following all of the wonderful protocols that happen to what it looks like to get somebody housed and all the federal regulations. Like, those things take time. And so that's what I mean when I talk about mercy ministry versus justice. There's nothing wrong if your church or, you know, congregation is doing a food pantry, like, please keep doing that because there are people who are hungry in your community. But the question is start to ask is why? Why are they hungry? Why are they unhoused? Why aren't they getting access to healthcare? Why don't they have an ID? Why can't they get a job? What are the barriers that we have created that are perpetuating homelessness and poverty, and how can we address those barriers and remove them?
Yeah, I've never kind of put these thoughts together, but as you were talking, it made me think about how this is like really representative of public health in a lot of ways, where like the Mercy Ministry, as you were talking about, there's people outside of your window right now at the Hope Partnership who are getting a hot meal, and like they're grateful for that and they need that hot meal right now. And then you're also doing work to change local policy, to start this kind of sustainable living space, to actually allow people to have a roof over their head consistently. And I think public health and medicine are very similar, where we talk about Mercy Ministries as like bandages, which bandages aren't bad. Like if someone's bleeding and has a wound, they need a bandage. They need medical care. They need a doctor to see them. And I think justice ministries, I would argue maybe even public health, we go upstream, right? Like we're trying to figure out how absolutely. Are people getting harmed, or how do we uproot these systems that are allowing for the constant need for mercy to be shown? And so they work in tandem. One is not better than the other. But like you said, you know, seeing your doctor and getting the prescription that you need to fix your, you know, your cold or whatever, or your illness. You know, this is an analogy, so I know it doesn't always work that way, but that's a lot quicker, right? Getting a hot meal is a lot quicker. It's this mercy, like, okay, in this moment, I'm getting what I need, versus how do we change public health policy? How do we change housing policy? How, you know, that justice long-term accompaniment is a little bit different. And it's, you know, language that, you know, maybe we're splitting hairs here for some people, but I do think it really matters in the ways that we build both Christian outreach, public health outreach, how we use our funds and our money to actually implement changes in our community.
Yeah. And for us, I mean, we have a public policy arm that, I mean, we have multiple entities as an organization, which I'm not going to get into right now, but one of them is called Hope Strategies, and Hope Strategies' job is to change public opinion and public policy. Because if I go outside right now and I talk to the people who are here for our Hope Cares Day, so that's what it's called, not Hope Center, Hope Cares Day. We do still have Hope Center. It's a whole long story, but right now is a Hope Cares Day. It happens every Monday. People can come and get access to meet some of their basic needs. We have a shower trailer. People can able, they're able to shower. They're able to get a hot meal. They're able to access IDs, get a cell phone, access to SNAP benefits, get a mailbox, just lots of basic needs that are happening out there right now. And those are important things. Like, we need those things for people. And we need more of them. Actually, we only really do it once a week, and that's honestly not enough. And I have a ton of other employees who are working on getting someone housed right now and working on doing all the behind the scenes paperwork that needs to happen, or transporting people to their doctor's appointments so that we can get them verified if they're, you know, chronically homeless, so we can get them verified that they might have some disabling condition and they've never been to the doctor before. And we need to verify that before we can get them into housing. And so there are so many different paths, and it is a lot of work. And I think, if anything, the biggest struggle that we have in our community is that people have unrealistic expectations about what it looks like to house someone. You know, they don't understand that the process is long. The process has a lot of hoops that have to be dropped, like just jumped through. And so when we do mercy ministry work, it's so tangible, like people can see it. And so, you know, we fed X amount of people, and that sounds really good. And I've housed significantly less people than we've fed. We've housed a lot of people, right? And that's important. But it's, you know, it's not 150 people a week that we're housing. And so that's hard when it comes to fundraising and figuring it out. And, you know, we still work very, very hard to educate. That's all what we're saying all the time. Just trying to help people understand that this is so multifaceted, and we are not after a quick fix. And we are not after a pat on our back with what we did today. That's not what we're after. We're after making the world better, one family at a time.
If you're enjoying today's discussion, don't forget to subscribe to the Healing Theology podcast on your favorite streaming platform. You can also visit us at healingtheology.com for more resources, show notes, and to join our growing community. You can also find us on social media at Healing Theology on all major social media platforms. Now let's get back to our conversation. I want to transition a little bit and kind of paint the picture and kind of set the scenes at the table of the space that you work in. Again, it's my childhood home. It's a space that you've known for a long time as well. So for us, we can imagine it, and we probably inherently know a lot of these spaces, but I want to explain it to our listeners. And so you're situated in Kissimmee, which is in Orlando, Florida. So it's surrounded by these kind of huge Central Florida economies of Disney and Universal. And the attractions is what, you know, we call them. And maybe our listeners don't know this. I have a pretty complicated feeling towards this area. I jokingly say that the mouse funded my childhood because my dad has been a Disney employee for a Disney cast member for 35 years. And that's what raised me. Like, we would go to the parks all the time and Disney has been my life. And so I have a complicated feeling of it, just seeing how these big organizations create a lot of quote unquote magic and also have pretty negative economic impacts in their local communities that they're situated in. I think I saw this just glaringly so during the pandemic and seeing how people were not supported by these giant conglomerates that bring in a lot of money and like people who are on the ground running. The actual everyday, the daily things of these attractions weren't getting protected during the pandemic, but it's happening now. It happened before the pandemic. The attractions are a complicated space. Can you give us a breakdown of what the Hope Partnership is seeing happen to Central Florida? Like why is this area such a unique space when we're talking about housing security?
Yeah. And I would say to you, and I say this pretty much to everyone, it's real easy to put all the blame of what's happened in this community on the parks. It's real easy. It's easy because they're so large and they are not solely responsible. And I will take you back 30 years ago, for actually 50 years ago, 50 years ago when this community was introduced to the idea of having a theme park. And I wish I didn't know this every day when I tell this story. I wish I didn't know that there were people who advocated to put housing for workers of the theme park, and they were turned down. And the decision makers at the time chose instead to focus on tourism. That is actually where we began to see our issues, is when we decided that we were going to build for tourism and we were going to build for people who could afford single family homes. And that has been our issue for many, many years in this community. We didn't build a lot of multifamily. We didn't build duplexes. We didn't build small single homes. We built huge, huge homes. If you look at some of the places that we know around our area where most of those homes now that were built in the 90s and the early 2000s, when there was a huge tourism boom, now a lot of those homes are Airbnbs, are being utilized that way. So we still have a housing issue because they're still not being utilized the way that we'd like them to be utilized. And we are seeing our community decision makers step into spaces where we are building more homes that work for multifamily, that are more accessible, that are more affordable. Now, do we see too many what I would call luxury apartments going up? Yes, way too many, way too many. And I know that the community is trying to build their way out of what happened. And the reality is that we are probably too far gone to build our way completely out. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't build. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. When it comes to both Universal and Disney, both of them have current housing projects open. They are building their own housing. Universal's doing a low income tax credit project that's about 1,000 units that will go up in the next couple of years. Disney is doing a private partnership program that is also housing that is going to go up hopefully by 2026. I'm actually, full disclosure, working with Disney on that project. And so I'm deeply engaged in the policy around what that looks like. And I'm actually really excited about it because it's one of the first times in this community that any private company has said, we are going to build affordable housing. So that's a huge deal. And so I think people are learning from the lessons of our past. I'm watching a new development happen in my community. We have a huge push to build out what's called Neo City, which is a smart city that will focus on semiconductor chips and bringing in more technology to the community. And there's a huge 50 to 75 year plan that's in place to build that out, to bring more employment into the community and to build our economy here away from the tourism industry. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm watching very closely is to make sure that we do not repeat the same mistakes that we repeated 50 years ago. As we build this new community of tomorrow, which is also one that we already have, but as we build this new community tomorrow, that we do so in a way that it makes sure it has housing for all. And that includes me flying to Korea and talking to Korean investors who are invested in Neo City about making sure that they are thinking about housing for all. So it's been an interesting path. And I always say when someone's like, oh, it's the park's fault. Sure. They have some blame, but the reality is that we're all to blame. We're all responsible in this community.
Yeah. I appreciate that kind of reframing too, because maybe it's more of a conversation around like tourism and the kind of prioritizing capitalism and profiting, which is not just Disney. I mean, the number of people, gosh, it's kind of crazy. Every time I go home, I'm like, just new, like Airbnbs everywhere. So many houses lay dormant because they're only rented out a part of the year. And yeah, maybe it's a reflection, right? Because it's easy to blame the big entities of Disney and Universal, which, as you said, I don't think that they can be removed in part of the conversation of blame. But also, like, how do we, even when we travel, right? Like, what organizations do we use around Airbnbs, hotels? Like, we all are visiting neighbors in other areas, whether it's Orlando or wherever we travel in. Maybe it's a good kind of moral reflection for our own traveling habits and who we support in that space.
One of the things that when I traveled this summer, one of the places I went was Barcelona. And Barcelona, while we were there and we were staying in an Airbnb, made the decision that in 2026, they're going to phase out all of their Airbnbs so that they have more housing opportunity. Mm. And I was like, I want to know more. I want to know how this is possible. I was meeting with some folks while I was there. I just try to talk to people. And so I like to hear what's happening around housing justice in other countries, because my goodness, I can learn from them. This is one thing that we can learn. And, you know, this one person is telling me, 50% of our housing stock is Airbnbs. And when they told me that, like, it pinged in my mind that one of our taglines for this community that we are in is that we are the vacation home rental capital of the world, that Central Florida is the vacation home capital of the world. And my thought was, if Barcelona is 50%, what are we? I don't know the stat. I would like to find out, but I haven't had a chance to do that work. But it immediately pinged, and I thought, it's such a double-edged sword, right? Because we do have tourism, and it is what makes this community work. And so when we think about, you know, how can we limit it in a way that we still, you know, will those folks, if we said, okay, you know, we're going to decrease our Airbnb stock by X amount by this year, like, will those folks turn those homes into affordable rentals, or will they be sold to investors and then become, you know, something that is still unaffordable for our community? And so I'm watching Barcelona very closely and to see, like, kind of what is going to happen when they make this choice and what that looks like. It's fascinating to me that they made that choice. And so I'm just really, really interested in what that looks like.
Wow. What a beautiful, radical way to say no more. Like, we're not going to get swept over by, because it's almost like a ghost land too. The idea of just having vacation rentals and, like, you don't have a community, you don't have neighbors, because we're more interested in profiting off of vacationers and travelers. I did not know that about Barcelona, and I'm not surprised. I did not know that Central Florida was known as the vacation home capital of the world, you said. I'm not surprised, though. I mean, it's truly, tourism is what fuel. I mean, I don't think I knew anybody that wasn't at least directly connected, or maybe one degree of separation connected to the tourism industry growing up. Everybody was employed in some capacity by tourism.
And I would like to throw in that, like, both of those entities that we mentioned, those large entities, are financial supporters of our work. And when it comes to, I would say both, Disney is a little bit more financially invested in our work than Universal, but they've also been good supporters. And there's other tourism industry folks who are our biggest financial supporters are the theme parks and the hospitals, honestly. Advent Health is probably my largest funder. Florida Blue is one of my largest funders. And so there are, you know, people in those spaces who are trying to be part of that. Orlando Health is a pretty large funder. So, you know, we're actively engaging with those entities about this work.
In conversation, like, how do we help each other? Is such an important component. I want to end the conversation with talking about politics, which I know is not the most, it's maybe a taboo way to end it. But, you know, I think just with the coming election that's right around the corner, I think we're like inching the 50-day mark. And I don't know if this episode will go out before the election, but I want to talk about Central Florida, not from the tourism standpoint, but from the, like, Florida politics standpoint. It's been such an interesting journey to watch Florida politics. It's just, you know, I love my state. I know you also love Florida. It's oftentimes the butt of political jokes, which is really frustrating. And our beautiful, though complex state has been impacted over the past recent years by some pretty, I would call it, radical right policies and ideologies, oftentimes religiously fueled as well. I'm wondering how conservative religious policymakers in the state and in local office are impacting the process that you all are trying to do around kind of affordable housing and eradicating poverty and homelessness.
Yeah, actually, this year, we really struggled because there is a right wing think group who doesn't believe in the housing first model. And so they actually really influenced a lot of our state reps and senators to pass a anti-camping bill around people sleeping outside. Mm. And it is state law, and it is already making my work much harder because now you can be criminalized for sleeping outdoors. And so that's going to add to the barriers that people have if they are arrested for basically sleeping, which is a human dignity. It's a human right to be able to sleep, my goodness. But if they're doing that in places where a community thinks is not where they should be sleeping, they can be arrested. And it's not in effect yet. I think it's coming down any minute. I think maybe starting October 1, actually. And so real upset about that because that was, and they, you know, they bought out ads in the Sentinel and editorials. And so we had to work very hard to like write things against it and call our folks. And I'm lucky in the sense that I am in Central Florida and we are like one little blue dot in a lot of red. And so my state folks, my state reps and senators are really quite great. And even we have one person who is a Republican, but still pretty supportive of our work and has always signed off on any state appropriations that we've gotten. We've gotten one state appropriation and we are approved for an additional one this year. And we were actually vetoed out of the budget this year because they did veto out anything that was housing related because I think because of this white right wing think group that was heavily influencing our governor. So I was in the budget and I got line item vetoed by the governor. So you can take that for what you want, how I feel about that. I don't think that we're on the right track when it comes to housing justice. Our community also for many, many years, one of the coolest things that we did in the 1990s was institute something called the Sadowski Funds, which is when any home that was built at closing time, a portion, they were charged basically a dock tax that would add into a housing fund. And that housing fund was supposed to be utilized to help people build housing. And it had millions upon millions of dollars in it. And our state legislator consistently year after year would raid that fund and use it for something else. And so what happened about 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, someone instituted that they were going to take the Sadowski funds and they were going to guarantee that I think it's like 20% will always go to housing and then they can use what the rest. And everybody was like, they saved Sadowski. And I was like, no, you did not save Sadowski. Mm-hmm. What you did, and what's to say somebody else is going to be like, never mind that 20%. Like, mm-hmm. And so we actually had money to build more housing in this community and in the state, and we didn't use it. And we still are not using it fairly, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Now, are there many, many other policies in effect that are rooted in what I would say full-on white supremacy and inequality, and I just don't even understand the motivation of these things except for pure evil, in my opinion. And those also deeply affect our work because those things make it more difficult for people to get into spaces of housing for whatever reason. And so one of the things that we talk about is racial justice. And there's a law on the books that if I don't make my trainings optional for my team members, they could sue us. So I have to say, like, you know, you can leave at any time when mm-hmm. we're talking about racial justice, which in my opinion is just full on bullshit. Sorry, yeah. But it is like, yeah. No, because this is a human dignity issue that we need to be addressing. And there is racial inequality in housing justice work. There are things that, you know, people, we know that Black and brown people are more susceptible to experiencing homelessness because of all the things that's happened before, redlining and the inability to live in certain areas because of redlining, or to buy homes, or to have mortgages. There's no generational real estate wealth because they couldn't buy homes in different spaces. And so that's continuing. We're continuing to see the effects of those decisions that were made. And I'm not even supposed to talk about that. I'm not supposed to tell people about that without saying it's optional legally, which is just ridiculous.
What do you have to say to our listeners as we near the election cycle, especially around topics at the local, state, and federal level in regards to homelessness and housing insecurity? How do we show up and support the work that you're doing in the way that we vote?
Yeah, I mean, from personally, you know, I am going to support whatever candidate is leaning into actual housing and is going to do that work. Listen to what the candidates are saying, listen to what they're actually saying, and then vote accordingly. I mean, as a nonprofit, we have to be very careful. We're not allowed as a nonprofit to endorse anyone or things like that. But personally, on my own time, I'm doing everything I can to get Harris elected, because to me, those are the policies that most align with the work that I'm doing. And I would say, like, there is lots of work to be done on the federal level that I would love to see. I do think a lot of our HUD funding is reactionary. I don't think we do enough justice work. I think it's still transactional. If my dream of dream would be to, yes, to have welfare reform, but not the way that some people talk about welfare reform. I would like to actually make it where it's dignified and not just transactional. And so those are, you know, those are things that I think people should pay attention to. If you hear people putting more money to HUD, like, obviously that's going to help our cause a lot. It's sometimes, you know, when we think about child tax credit is another huge one. When the child tax credit was reimbursable, childhood poverty, they told us they thought it would decrease by 50%, which I was like, really? Is that possible? It actually decreased by 60% nationwide.
Oh, wow.
And I can tell you, like, firsthand on the ground, I saw far less kids here, far less moms with kids, because they were getting adequate funding to pay their bills and to feed their children.
Yeah, I think it's a really important reminder, because I think some of the things you're talking about are specific to your local space, and then others are obviously specific to the kind of federal, something that we're all going to be looking at no matter where we're listening in from. But there's so many sneaky ways that local elections, local bills, state bills can impact the work that you're doing, whether it's in Florida or in another state. I had never really thought about how child tax credits could impact housing. I mean, the trickle down component of that makes sense, but there's so many layers of how we police, how we create policies around how the jargons that we use, the language that we use that would impact housing security, housing accessibility. And so just, I guess, a reminder to our listeners, like, read your bills. Like, what is your local space, like your local county voting on? Like, who are the people you're voting into election? I think local politics are they're so important. And I think we underestimate the impacts that they have on our everyday life because we're so focused on the federal campaigns or on the state campaigns. So yeah, I guess just, and I think I've said this in every episode, just be informed. Be an informed voter is such an important way to show up for your family and neighbor.
And if you don't have time to do that research, there's lots of different entities who are doing that research for you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, find an organization in your community that you trust. And find out if they are putting out, you know, at least policy wise, you know, not, there are nonprofits who have a different designation than our nonprofit who are able to endorse candidates and who will tell you, like, these are the candidates that are most in line with our work. And, you know, you definitely have places to look. You don't have to completely don't understand the language of the bill or you don't understand the language of the amendment. There are people who are doing that work that you can reach out to for support.
The internet is a powerful tool if we use it that way. I am so grateful to have this conversation with you and just to learn by the work that you're doing. And I don't know, I think there's a really beautiful intentionality behind the whole partnership, the justice ministry that you're leading, and just the way that we talk about housing security, homelessness. So I'm grateful for the time that you've spent with us.
I firmly believe that everyone is beloved. That they are fully beloved and they deserve to have good things. They deserve to have housing and they deserve to have healthcare because they are beloved.
Thank you for that. I would love to end our podcast as I do with every guest, which is by asking the Furious Five. It should be kind of first thing that comes to your head. It doesn't have to be anything super in depth by any means, but it's just five questions I like to ask. They kind of fall on a gradient of like connected to the topic we've been talking about in seriousness. And then it ends with something just a little bit more lighthearted. So would you like to answer our Furious Five?
Let's try it.
Awesome. If you could instantly solve one challenge related to the intersection of public health and religion, housing insecurity, what would it be and what would you envision the magic wand solution to be?
Yeah, the magic wand would be better reform from a federal level to understand what it's like to be on the ground. So a strong understanding of that and some integration between the two.
What do you believe is the most significant obstacle that we need to overcome in this near future to improve the relationship between public health, housing, and religion?
Relationships and the willingness to not be radicalized. Mm-hmm. Because for me, that's what I see. I see people who are radicalized at this point. And so it's impossible to educate or advocate when you have been radicalized.
On the topic of religion, health, homelessness, housing, security, do you have any recommendations for our listeners, whether it's a book, a podcast, a show, anything like that?
You want to have some good understanding about what it's like for a person experiencing poverty or homelessness. Made is an excellent book that's more recent. The title or the author has slipped my mind. But also, if you look into a book that was written farther back, but I think is so great, and one I just like recommend to everyone always, is Nickeled and Dimed, which is actually based in Florida. You can also, if you want to understand my work at an intimate level, you can watch The Florida Project, which is a film that is a fictional account of what it's like for a child to live in a motel and hotel. And I was very lucky to be able to work on that film along with the director. And so my name's in the credits. You can look for my name. It's very small and it's at the end. I am currently reading The Mystics Would Like a Word, which is by Shannon Evans and is phenomenal. I'm already really enjoying it. I'm only about a chapter in, but theologically, I'm finding a lot of alignment with it and the way that it's embracing our desert mothers and our saints of old who were powerful mystics and powerful prayer warriors and manifestors of a better world. Mm. And it's about how we can learn from them. And I think it's really good.
Where are you finding joy and hope these days?
And for me, it is definitely in opportunities of travel. Sometimes I need to step away from this neighborhood so I can see a different neighborhood. And it gives me hope to come back to the work. It gives me hope and to see when I talk about this work in other spaces, when I share and people are impacted by it, it reminds me that, yeah, it is good. Sometimes it doesn't feel good. Sometimes it feels like no change is happening. It feels like I'm stuck. Stuck is my like biggest fear. I never want to be mm-hmm. stuck. And so, yeah, that's really helpful to me to get out of here sometimes to hear from other people and other places and getting to do that with my family. For my children to experience the world, see them experiencing the world brings me a lot of joy. I'm trying to raise, I have, you know, three kids that I'm trying to raise to figure out the world in a different way than the way it is right now. So that, you know, people talk to me all the time, like, you know, like, what do you want your legacy to be? And like, I hate that term legacy. I'm not a big fan of it, but what I do want is I want my children to grow up to be good humans, and to be good citizens of the world. So that gives me a lot of hope to do that.
And lastly, where can people connect with you?
I am on LinkedIn and you can definitely find me there. But I am also very bad about responding on LinkedIn. So also, if I don't get back immediately, that's why. But I am on LinkedIn. You can connect with me there.
And we will also put the Hope Partnership website on our show notes as well. So you can check them out there and look at all the amazing work that they're doing and also support them financially if that is something that you feel called to. Reverend Mary, thank you so much for being here with us again and sharing your wisdom. It's just a huge honor to have you on the podcast.
I think you're amazing. Happy to be here.
Thank you for listening to the Healing Theology Podcast. We hope today's episode brought you new insights and inspired you to think differently about the intersection of religion and public health. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a rating or a review, as it really helps others find this podcast. And remember to subscribe so that you never miss a future episode. For more information, resources, and today's show notes, and also to connect with us, please visit us at healingtheology.com. Until next time, stay curious, stay compassionate, and keep the conversation going.